Great. Just to reiterate, please feel free to stop me anytime and ask as many questions as you'd like. This isn't my usual audience by any means, and they've asked me to give a pretty technical tutorial. So this is a pretty technical topic on sum of squares hierarchies. But what I want to do is I want to present an emerging set of techniques within theoretical computer science that actually seem like they might have a lot of interaction with the statistical physics crowd. So recently, in our fervor to understand upper and lower bounds through hierarchies, we've actually converged on more of Bayesian ways of thinking. So what I want to do is I want to present you with some of the recent work that people have been doing and even some older work just in a new light. So I want to start off with one of the classic optimization problems in theoretical computer science. It's something that's driven a ton of work. It's a very basic problem. It's called the max cut problem. So in the max cut problem, you're given a graph G, and the goal is to find a cut. So here, a cut means a subset of the nodes. So this is the set U. So on one side, you have the set U, and on the other side of the cut, you have all of the other nodes. And what you care about is how many edges are crossing the cut. So how many edges have one endpoint in one side in U and the other in V minus U? And you want to find a cut that maximizes the number of crossing edges. So that's the max cut problem. Now, this problem is a very basic one. In fact, it goes back to really the starting point of computational complexity because it was actually on Karp's original list of 21 NP-hard problems. So we know this problem is hard. We know that if you're given something like a bipartite graph, then you can cut all the edges and it's easy. But the basic question is really how well can you approximate max cut? So in fact, what I claim is that there's a really trivial approximation algorithm. Now, what you could do is you could do something really dumb, which is you could just choose the set U randomly. For every node in the graph, you include it equally likely with probability of half, or you don't include it. Now, what this means is that actually, if you look at any particular edge, it has a half chance of being cut because there's exactly a half chance that one endpoint will be on one side and one will be on the other. So in fact, not only is this a half approximation algorithm, but it tells you that you can always cut at least half of the edges. So in fact, this really basic optimization problem really came to the forefront when people started studying questions like, can you do better? So for a long time within theoretical computer science, the approaches to getting better approximation algorithms were always through linear programming. And what was really special about max cut was it was the first place where semi-definite programming got used. And so it's one of these landmark problems that actually has played an even sharper role in a lot of the later theory.
Minimum cuts with the top, the number on each side, max low, whatever. That can be done. The max thing is hard.
Right. So that's a good question. So you can do min cut for sure in a graph. Now, min cut, there the goal is to find a cut which cuts the fewest possible edges. That you can do with min cut max flow. Now, that actually has some issues where for a lot of problems, you really care about finding balanced cuts. So if you think about doing min cut in a social network or something, what'll end up happening is you'll pick off very isolated nodes and they won't be meaningful. So a lot of times what people study are things like balanced cuts or min bisection. Now, those problems turn out to be NP-hard as well, and that's sort of not surprising because when you talk about min bisection versus max bisection, then you can take the complement of the edges and they're related. So that's a good question, but yeah, that's exactly what makes this problem NP-hard. So in fact, what I'm going to do, because I'm really going to be working up towards some of the most powerful tools in theoretical computer science, which are called the sum of squares hierarchy, I want to first put max cut into a more convenient form for what we're going to do later, which is for max cut and for a wide variety of problems, you can often formulate them as polynomial optimization problems. So here I've got a polynomial in the objective function, and I've got polynomial constraints. So I've got one variable xi for each of the nodes in the graph. And the way to think about this is that these polynomial constraints down here, they just enforce the fact that the xi values are 0, 1 valued, right? And then if the xis are 0, 1 valued, what this is doing is you can think about all of the xis, which are 1, that would form your set U, and all of the rest would be the set V minus U. And this objective function would just contribute a 1 if that edge has the property that it's crossing the cut and 0 otherwise. So this is a faithful expression of the problem. So of course, polynomial optimization is NP-hard, so I haven't really accomplished much yet. But now I can introduce something called the sum of squares hierarchy. So the sum of squares hierarchy is a family of convex relaxations that are increasingly tighter for polynomial optimization problems. So just to tell you a little bit about, you know, why it plays such a central role in theoretical computer science. So it was introduced actually independently in two works, one by Pablo Perillo in his PhD thesis and one by J.B. Lasserre. And, you know, I haven't really told you what it is yet, but let me tell you at least some of the footnotes in its CV. So, you know, what's important is that many other hierarchies of convex programs are weaker than it, actually provably weaker. So other things that you may have heard of are things like the Shirley-Adams hierarchy, the Lovaas-Shriver hierarchy, and the LS-plus hierarchy. And sum of squares, what I'm going to introduce on the next slide, actually subsumes all of them. So it's one of the most powerful tools that we can leverage for a lot of problems. It turns out to be a very successful convex programming relaxation, so I'll show you what it does for max cut, but there are other problems like sparsest cut and unique games where it's really the best hope we have. In fact, there are some beautiful other results that if you think about things like random constraint satisfaction problems, then there's this really nice result of Lee, Raghavendra, and Stoyer, which shows that if you can prove lower bounds for random CSPs against the sum of squares hierarchy, you get lower bounds against all semi-definite programming relaxations. So that's pretty amazing that it actually has the strong property that it's sort of the right one to study. And more recently and more relevantly for this talk, it started to become one of the go-to algorithms for a lot of average case problems. So things like planted sparse vector, dictionary learning, tensor completion, tensor PCA. And in the last half of the talk, I'm going to talk about what's known about it and the planted clique problem.
What is semi-definite programming? What are you going
to say? Yeah, so semi-definite programming. You know, I'm not going to give a full-fledged introduction to STPs, but I'm going to tell you an optimization problem that you can solve, that can be solved through STPs. But the way to think about it is that what you can do is you can maximize. Think about C and X as being matrices, so these are the matrix inner products. And what you have are constraints that you have a bunch of linear functions AI. These are supposed to be equal to the BIs. Now, if this was all I wrote, this would just be linear programming because I would have variables for the X's and then have a bunch of linear equations and some linear objective function. But the important thing about semi-definite programs is that you also put this constraint that X is positive semi-definite, that all of its eigenvalues are non-negative. So what this means is that the feasible region is now no longer a polytope or a polyhedron, it's actually a cone. But you can nevertheless solve this with all of the usual techniques, things like the ellipsoid algorithm, work for actually solving these types of relaxations. So I'm going to describe the sum of squares, but I'm trying to do it in a way that I reduce the amount of baggage that I have to, you know, burden you guys with. And the way to think about it is that sum of squares is going to be a way of creating a gigantic semi-definite program with tons and tons of constraints that get increasingly tighter as we go to higher levels. But please stop me anytime with these questions. So in fact, what I'm going to do, just to sort of unburden you, is there's actually a usual way of introducing sum of squares, and sum of squares has this reputation of being a highly technical thing. Usually it's introduced as some kind of proof system related to Hilbert's 17th problem about non-negativity. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to spare you and not do that. I'm going to introduce actually the dual view of sum of squares that actually plays a lot nicer with sort of a Bayesian way of thinking about it. And that's the way we're going to derive upper and lower bounds anyways. So now I can finally tell you the way that I want you to think about sum of squares for this talk, is you should think about sum of squares as looking for an operator, this E tilde, which is called the pseudo-expectation. And what the pseudo-expectation operator is going to do, it's going to have a variety of constraints that we're going to impose on it. But what it's going to do is it's going to take any degree D polynomial in N variables, and it's going to map it to a real value. Now the point is that the constraints we're going to put on E tilde are going to force it to behave like it's actually some kind of expectation, but there's a tilde because it's not really an expectation. So that's the pseudo aspect of it, so it's called the pseudo expectation. And let's try and understand this concretely for what it would look like for max cut. So now I can actually give you the sum of squares relaxation. So what you do for max cut, the first thing is you have this objective function. No surprise there, we had this original objective function, which was sum over the edges of xi minus xj squared, We'll just put an E tilde around it, because we're looking for some kind of thing that behaves like a distribution on solutions, except for the fact that it's not a distribution on solutions, it's not the expectation, it's some other operator, E tilde, that has these self-consistency properties. So if you had an expectation, so an actual operator that mapped a polynomial to distributions over 0, 1 vectors, what are some of the properties it better have? Well, it better have the property that that operator is linear because of linearity of expectation. You put in two polynomials, e tilde of p plus q, better be equal to e tilde of p plus e tilde of q. That's fine. You better map the value 1 to 1 because that's the expectation of 1. Now, really, the main constraints come in constraint 3. This is where all of the magic of semi-definite programming shows up, is that if you think about a square polynomial, so if you have the polynomial p squared, if you really did take the expectation of that polynomial over distributions on assignments to its variables, that expectation would be non-negative. So that's a constraint that you can impose, is that e tilde for any square polynomial actually is non-negative. And that's exactly where constraints like this come in about the positive semi-definiteness of some matrix. Now, those are all general constraints. Those are sanity checks. If e tilde is supposed to behave like an expectation, you better have conditions 1 through 3. Now, you also have some conditions that are specific just to the optimization problem you care about, because remember in MaxCut, we had the objective function, which was a polynomial, and we had constraints, which were polynomials. So the way that we enforce the constraints, which were polynomials, which were saying we only care about 0, 1 assignments, is that we say that anytime you take a polynomial which looks like xi squared times p, e tilde applied to that better be the same as e tilde of xi times p. Because after all, if xi squared is always supposed to be equal to xi for all I, then this would also be satisfied in a distribution on satisfying assignments. So in fact, this is a very specific formulation, but you can believe me at this point that there's a formulaic recipe that when you have a polynomial optimization problem with a polynomial objective function and polynomial constraints, there's a way to take these constraints 1 through 3 that always arise and then actually specialize your pseudo-expectation to the problem that you have at hand. So this is actually one of the most technical parts in the talk, so I definitely want to take some questions. I saw a hand already. It's a pseudo-expectation because, as we'll see, the fact that you have an e tilde that meets all of these conditions does in no way mean that there's an actual distribution that satisfies.
Preclude an actual
distribution? No. So, in fact, what I'm going to do, but I'll give you a little foreshadowing of this, is that for MaxCut, we're going to see that it's going to come from a degree 2 relaxation. So we're only going to go out to degree 2 when we study these constraints. It'll turn out in that case that we really can find a distribution that matches the moments, but after degree 2, that will be wildly false. So it will not be true anymore, and that's really one of the distinctions between 2-sat being easy and 3-sat being hard. You can make that precise. But, you know, that's where some of the magic comes in, is that this is trying to behave like an expectation, but it's not quite. So a lot of, you know, approaches for rounding these hierarchies and showing that they really do well for an optimization problem are based on trying to understand why you can pretend they really are distributions anyways. And lower bounds are about creating fake ones that act like them even though there is no distribution to speak of. Yep?
A true expectation will satisfy these properties.
Yep, so I'm going to show that in a second. Because one of the first questions that, so as I mentioned, just to reiterate, 1 through 3 are the usual conditions on a pseudo-expectation regardless of your particular polynomial optimization problem you want to solve. And 4 is something that's a constraint specific to the problem. But now to get to your question, which is really trying to ask, why is this a relaxation? So, you know, why is this a relaxation for the original polynomial optimization problem? So let's see that. So here's a... So D is the degree D pseudo-expectation relaxation, so it's a parameter. So in fact, as D becomes larger and larger, we have a larger and larger semi-definite program. So this is what makes it a sort of tunable algorithm in the sense that when you go up to D being linear, like something like N, the number of nodes in the graph, you get exponential time algorithms, but it turns out that all pseudo-expectations are expectations, and it's an exact relaxation. So most of the work in this area is about understanding how large does D need to be to actually solve some particular optimization problem.
What does
what does B correspond to in the problem that you wrote on the board?
So D, I haven't, oh, that, let me table that for a second. I'll get to this after this claim. So ask me again in a second. So first claim is just that, you know, I haven't told you why I can solve this optimization problem efficiently, and that's what your question is about. I'll get to that right after, I promise. But the first question is, what does it have to do with our original optimization problem? So what I claim, this is a very simple claim, but it's a good one to think through carefully, is that it really is a relaxation. So if there is a cut in your graph that cuts at least k edges, I claim there's a way to create a pseudo-expectation that meets all of these conditions and has its objective value being at least k.
The objective value is this e tilde of the
The max of this e tilde. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So what's the proof? The proof is really short and simple. It's what you expect it is. So imagine that you give me a cut u, so the actual set u. What I'm going to do is I'm going to set a1 through an are going to be the indicator vectors, the indicator variables of the corresponding node, which, whether it's in the side u or on the other side. So for a1, I'm going to put the value 1 if it's in the set u and 0 otherwise. And what do I do? Now I can build for you a pseudo-expectation operator. Anytime you give me a polynomial, all I'm going to do is I'm going to plug in a1 through an for it. Why does this satisfy the constraints? Well, let's just go through. Well, first of all, it's obviously linear, because if I put in the sum of two polynomials, I'm explicitly just adding up the evaluations of the two polynomials. Why is e tilde of 1, 1? There's nothing to substitute, so it's 1. And in fact, you know, why is constraint 3 hold? When you put in a square polynomial and I evaluate it, it's literally a square polynomial, so it's non-negative. And of course, you know, why does it satisfy constraint 4 is because I'm plugging in 0, 1 values. And you can check that now when I plug in for x1 to xn these values a1 to an, what happens to the objective function? The same as our polynomial optimization problem, it counts the number of edges crossing the cut. So in fact, not only if I had an actual cut, what if I had a distribution on cuts whose expectation was at least k? Then I could, instead of evaluating the polynomial, I could look at the expected evaluation of the polynomial. So that's the sense in which it really clarifies some of the things that I was sketching before, which is that these are all constraints that the expectation would have if it were the expectation with respect to a distribution on feasible solutions. So when I relax it and only ask for something that satisfies these constraints, I'm getting an easier optimization problem. So are there any questions about that? That's
if
one of the...
Given a distribution, yeah. Then it really is an expectation. You can write it down.
Right. Well, given, yeah, so given an expectation, I can build a pseudo-expectation operator just by setting it equal to the expectation. Perfect. Great.
But there might be pseudo-expectations that satisfy 1 to 4 that are totally not relaxing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's always the name of the game for these things, because for max cut, we're going to see why, you know, we can get a good approximation algorithm out of it. But for other problems, that's not necessarily the case, and then we're proving lower bounds. So I'll do both upper and lower bounds, sort of, in this talk, but the upper bound I'll do in full. All right, great. So there should be one other question which is on your mind, which is, I just wrote down a different optimization problem, so can it actually be efficiently solved? So one thing that I can just tell you, and you can just take this on faith if you don't know some of the semi-definite programming things, but what I claim is that there is an end of the D time algorithm for finding such an operator if it exists. See, D is the degree that we go out to the relaxation. So in fact, as D becomes larger and larger, we have many more constraints because we have a constraint for all degree D polynomials, actually for all degree D over 2 ones, because we take their square and their pseudo-expectation better be non-negative. So they're about end of the D of those polynomials, so we need something that grows like end of the D. Yep. Max of what?
The max operator.
Yep.
Is about maximum
so that I'm just trying to find it's a max over e tildes. So you're looking for an e tilde that satisfies these conditions and which maximizes the evaluation of what e tilde maps this polynomial to. That polynomial in the objective function. Does that make sense? Yeah, so max over e tildes that satisfy constraints 1 through 4 of the value that e tilde assigns to the polynomial that appears inside its brackets. Good.
Another question on whether you get the lower bound upper bound. So if you can certify that there's at least one pseudo expectation that provides the right, the right solution, the maximum where all it in that provides you an upper bound.
Exactly. Yeah.
But if you cannot prove that, maybe it's because you are not able to prove it. So taking the maximum pseudo expectation is always a lower bound.
Upper bound for a maximization problem, because
you cannot prove that there is at least one pseudo expectation that's, that matches the
So for this one, right, E tilde is less constrained than an actual expectation over cuts. So in fact, for this maximization problem, I'm going to get an upper bound, exactly. So the name of the game, which I will get to, I promise, is you know, if you get a large value for the pseudo expectation, why does that tell you that there is at least a not too large value for the actual max cut? That's not at all obvious, but I'll prove it for you.
Like in general, you can prove that it's always an upper bound. Yeah,
it's always a relaxation. Yeah, it's a relaxation. Okay, so this you can take on faith. I can tell you a sketch of how it works for those of you who know what a semi-definite program is. Well, basically the idea is really, you know, you have these constraints 1 through 4. Really 3 is the heart of the constraints. And what you can do is, see, the pseudo expectation is linear anyways. So all you have to do is figure out what its evaluation is on different monomials. So based on writing down a table of its values, of what it evaluates to on different monomials, there's a way to check that it maps to something that's non-negative on all degree d over 2 polynomials that you square, just by ensuring that there's no quadratic form on that particular end of the d by end of the d matrix that's negative. So it turns out that you can write it down as a semi-definite program in which this x constraint is really, you know, size end of the d by size end of the d, and the actual entries are the evaluations of E tilde on some monomials. But we can take this on faith for this talk because it's not super important. This is something that you can solve in end of the D time. But really the heart of, you know, what I want to tell you about is, why does it work? And actually, why does it not work in some cases? So first, let me start off with why does it work? So how well does sum of squares approximate max cut? So there's this really famous result of Gomans and Williamson, which is like the landmark result in the area. It was the first place where any kind of semi-definite programs were used. So it was for the max cut problem, and what they showed was that there's an alpha, now it's usually called the Gomans-Williamson constant, approximation algorithm for max cut, and it beats 50-50.
What year was that?
This was 1994, was the journal version. Yeah, actually, the ironic thing is that semi-definite programs appear earlier in, like, Cravine's proof of Grothendieck's inequality, but they weren't really stated as algorithms at the time because we didn't have the ellipsoid algorithm, but that's a separate issue. So in any case, they showed that there's this 0.878, at least, approximation algorithm. And actually, one cool thing that I'm just going to tell you informally is that it turns out that if you could beat this approximation factor, alpha Gomans-Williamson, even by an additive 0.0000001, all hell would break loose. So we could actually all go home within theoretical computer science. It turns out that something called the unique games conjecture would be false, which Subhash Kote won the Nevelina Prize for recently. So this turns out to not be an accident by any stretch of the imagination. You can ask me more about that offline, but that's really the subject for a different talk. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a proof of this using the degree 2 sum of squares relaxation. Now, this is actually not how Gomans and Williamson originally proved it, but this gives you a good understanding of, you know, how you can think about a pseudo-expectation in a Bayesian way anyways, despite the fact that there really is no distribution to speak of. So it's a good sort of warm-up before we get into the more modern things about things like planted clique, which are going to be hard. So, you know, the main question is, if I give you a pseudo-expectation operator that satisfies these constraints 1 through 4 and has a large objective value, what does that have to do with having a large max cut in the graph at all? So remember that whatever we achieve for E tilde is an upper bound on what we can achieve for the max cut problem. So when I give you some large value for what E tilde can achieve, subject to those constraints, what I care about is showing that, you know, within this alpha factor, I can get at least 0.878 times its expectation. I can cut that many edges. So that's the main question, is how do I find a cut that cuts at least 0.878 times the objective value of E tilde, number of edges. So the main idea for this is actually pretty simple. It's a technique that's going to work really well with degree two relaxations. Is what we're going to do is we're actually going to turn it into an actual distribution. So we're going to find a Gaussian random variable that matches on the moments, and we're going to use that Gaussian random variable to decide which one is on which cut, which side of the cut, and which one's on the other. But as a caveat, all of this breaks down when you go past degree two, because it's not true that you can match the pseudo moments with the moments of an actual distribution anymore. So let me at least show you this concrete rounding algorithm. So what I claim is that without loss generality, you can assume that E tilde maps each xi to the value half. Now, I have a bunch of technical things I'm going to do in this talk, so I don't really want to waste time with this particular thing. This is kind of boring. The intuition for it is just the cut value, the number of edges cut, is the same if I interchange u and v minus u. You can do the same thing with an actual pseudo-expectation where you sort of symmetrize it in this way, and each node will have half probability of being in u or in v minus u. So there's some simple symmetrization technique that's the same as interchanging u and v minus u, because they both cut the same number of edges. But now I want to show you this Gaussian rounding technique. So if you give me the pseudo-expectation operator, here's what I'm going to do. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to create a vector mu of means. So I take this vector x of x1, x2, up to xn, and I take the pseudo-expectation of it component-wise. That's a vector mu which, by assumption, is all half now. And what I'm going to do is I'm then going to take its covariance. So once I've fixed whatever this vector mu is, in our case it's all half, I'm going to take this matrix where I take the vector of x's, I subtract off half from them, I take it times itself transpose, and I apply the pseudo-expectation operator entry-wise to this matrix. And that gives me some sort of covariance sigma. So you can check that sigma is positive semi-definite. Why? Because if not, I could take a quadratic form on it, which is negative, and that would give me a polynomial, which is square, whose expectation is negative. So now what I'm going to do is, all I do for my rounding algorithm, the simple thing will work, is I take y, which is a Gaussian random vector with this mean mu, and covariance sigma. And for each of the coordinates, I round it. If it's less than or equal to a half, I set it equal to 0. I put the corresponding node outside the set u. And if it's above a half, I put the corresponding node in the set u. So this is my rounding algorithm. I told you, yeah, so y is a sample, is a Gaussian random vector with mean mu and covariance sigma. So one time you take a Gaussian random sample, and then you coordinate-wise round it to get your indicator vector of the set u. Does that make sense?
It's of the dimension of number of
nodes, exactly, yeah. Because in fact, you think about E tilde of x, that's a vector whose dimension is the number of nodes. So I'm taking a Gaussian random vector with mean mu and covariance sigma. That's length n and n by n for the matrix.
So what's Bayesian about this all?
Nothing yet.
Okay.
We will get there.
Okay.
So any other questions about the rounding algorithm? Now I have to prove it works. But you know what we want to show is that for the randomized rounding that we had, for the assignments that we found, well, this would just count the number of edges crossing, because it's the actual expectation now, because we're really creating a random cut out of this pseudo-expectation. We want that to be at least 0.878 times what the objective value is.
Where is the graph in there?
So the graph comes from the... Exactly. So it's in the objective function of the pseudo-expectation operator. So in fact, what I do is I solve this relaxation to optimality. The graph only shows up in the objective function. Exactly. And the pseudo expectation is above whatever the actual max cut value is, so that's the way it's baked in. Great. Terrific. And please keep the questions coming. This is certainly a technical area. All right, so now we're here, and we want to prove that we actually, in expectation, cut a large fraction of the edges that the pseudo expectation thinks it's cutting. So let's do that. In fact, it'll just be a one-slide analysis. So, and then let's see where each of these things come from. So the first thing I'm going to do is I want to calculate for each edge, ij, what its contribution is to the objective value. So what is its contribution? It's literally e tilde of xi minus xj squared. Now what I can do is I can expand it out, and then what property of e tilde have I used in this equation?
Linearity.
Great. What property have I used here? Number four, perfect, awesome. So I use the fact, see, it's fun. You just have to, you know, choose which constraint you're using at each time. Great. So I map the xi squared to xi because, you know, these are supposed to be Boolean valued. And now I'm going to do this rewriting of it. So I'm going to say that rho, I'm going to define it as 4 times e tilde of xi xj minus 1. And I'm just doing a little bit of arithmetic here because the point is that e tilde of xi is 1. E tilde of xj is 1, so it's really 1 minus 2 times e tilde of xi xj, and I'm just writing it in this more convenient form, because I take 1 minus rho, so that's really 2 minus 4 times the e tilde, and then I take the half and I get the corresponding thing that I said. Yeah, rho has an ij index, but I'm going to focus on just one ij, yep. So e tilde of xi is half, but I have the xj too, so I'm adding them up, and I get 1.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that I get 1 minus 2 times the e tilde, and then it's equal to this expression for rho. Okay, great. And then the only thing I have left to do is to count the expected number of edges crossing the cut. So I want to calculate the chance that this ij edge shows up in this Gaussian rounding procedure crossing the cut. So how do I do this? The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to do a little bit of a helper here, which is that I'm going to calculate the variance of yi. Remember, yi is a Gaussian random variable. In fact, you know, we know what its expectation is. Its expectation is a half, just by construction. And its variance is the corresponding entry along, you know, the covariance matrix, because it's just, you know, the e tilde of xi minus mu that's squared. And it's the same thing you always get. It's the e tilde of xi minus a half squared. And you can expand this out and then check that, you know, I'm going to get the minus 1/4, and then the e tilde of xi squared is going to go to e tilde of xi because of our constraints. And that itself is a half, so I'm going to get the value 1/4. And the same way I can calculate the covariance of yi, yj, well, that is explicitly rho. Because you know, that's exactly the sort of way that I've constructed, it's rho over 4, because that's the way I've constructed it. It's that e tilde of xi times xj minus 1/4, because that's the product of their means. So now I'm in business, because what I can do is I can calculate the probability that the ij edge is cut. So the probability that ai is not equal to aj. Well, the important thing is that what are yi and yj? They're rho correlated Gaussians. Yes, exactly. Because y is a Gaussian random variable, but the way that I set its moments was based on the pseudo moments. Exactly. And maybe that's one of the most confusing parts of this. But now, you know, I know that yi and yj are rho correlated Gaussian random variables, right? So what's the probability that their sign is off? Well, you can jointly sample rho correlated Gaussians just by taking, you know, two independent standard Gaussians and then having, you know, taking S for one of them and then, you know, doing the sort of usual Ornstein-Uhlenbach thing, right? And this has a very nice explicit formula. It's arc cos rho over pi. And now we're done. That's it. So what's the proof? So let's put it together in one line. So for every edge ij, we know that the probability that it's cut is at least Well, it's the ratio of these two things. So we get this 2 arc cos rho over 1 minus rho pi times the contribution to the objective function. That's at least alpha Gomans-Williamson. That's it. Are there any questions about the Gaussian rounding? This is true for any xi and xj. So the edges only come in through the objective function of the pseudo expectation. That's kind of an amazing part about the rounding algorithm.
So can you now indicate why if one beats this constant, it's
relativistic? No. So it turns out that there's something called the unique gains conjecture within theoretical computer science, which is really related to something called the PCP theorem. So it's a strengthening of something that really is a theorem. It says that a particular problem is NP-hard, but that problem being NP-hard, people have worked over the last 10 years and shown that it implies lots of tight hardness of approximation. So it turns out that there first are actual graphs that are as bad as this alpha Gomans-Williamson. And they sort of come by taking the sphere and connecting things at the right angle from each other. And that's because that's where all of these inequalities would be tight in this approximation algorithm. The amazing thing is that you can turn those into NP-hard, you know, optimization problems. So they end up being gadgets and some kinds of reductions that say that if you could beat this, you know, the unique gains conjecture would be false, and all of these sort of house of cards about our hardness of approximation results would fall. Now, we couldn't all go home in the sense of P equals NP, but some fraction of us could go home.
So really, you can choose, in the way you say
that. No, because it comes out of the objective function.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So that's why, in fact, what's amazing here is that you can actually, if the max cut is close to cutting all the edges, you can do better than the Gomans-Williamson approximation algorithm. And you can do better because rho is constrained. But that's a great question. So I have other stuff I want to talk about, so maybe I'll move on from max cut, but feel free to ask me other questions afterwards. So I gave you one example of how to actually round a solution to sum of squares and turn it into an approximation algorithm. But now one of the things that people like myself and others have...
Stupid question. You used Gaussian distribution.
Yep.
Why Gaussian? Why not any other?
Because as long as you have the moments, the second moments are, you know, PSD, you can match it with a Gaussian. So it's complete in that way. One thing I'll just assert, which I'm not going to get to in this talk, is that if you have a pseudo expectation operator that, you know, it's degree 3 or degree 4, it turns out to not be true that you can find a random variable whose moments match. And that ends up being the case because of things like 3-sat. We know that finding satisfying assignments is hard for 3-sat, in a worst-case sense, certainly. And the important thing is that we can have a pseudo-expectation that up to all triples of variables, it looks like it satisfies all the clauses. But there won't be a satisfying assignment to that, you know, formula, and then that means that there is no distribution that matches up to the third moments. So it really... What?
The alpha GW is a worst case.
It's a worst case, exactly. Yep.
But if you want to use in practice one of these relaxation, you have to compute the sigma, the covariance matrix, based on the actual graph that you're solving?
No, because actually the graph would only show up in the part where I hand off the graph to the semi-definite program, you know, the SDP solver. And whatever the SDP solver spits out, I don't actually need to know the graph after that. Because the pseudo-expectation already has baked in all of the information about, you know, in an indirect way, where the edges are. Because the, you know, the actual variables which have small covariance, those are going to be trying to be the ones where there are edges. So it's sort of indirect because it shows up to a certain extent in the actual solution that the SDP spits out. Great. Now I'm going to tell you about something actually a little bit more technical, which is, see, recently people have been using sum of squares hierarchies as a way to give evidence about average case hardness. So not rounding sum of squares, but fooling sum of squares. as some sort of way of understanding, well, this problem ought to be hard, even though we can't prove it via NP-hardness reductions. I'll say more about that, but let me start off with a basic problem, which a bunch of you have probably seen. So there's the planted cleek problem, which goes back to Jerram and Kucera. Actually, a variant of it was introduced even in Karp's ICM paper. But you know what it is it's a very simple model for random graphs. You start off with Erdős-Reinl random graph. You generate GN 1/2. And then what I do is I plant a clique. I choose a random set of omega vertices, uniformly at random. And then within that set, I add all the edges that weren't already there in the graph. So I just make sure that there really is a clique on those nodes. And then I forget where I added the clique. So the goal is, given this graph in the second stage,
fully connected,
exactly. So all I'm doing here is I'm starting off with Erdős-Reinl. I pick omega random nodes. Any edge that wasn't already in the graph between them, I put it in. So that way they have a clique, it's fully connected. And then I forget where the clique is, and I hand you off the graph with a random permutation of the nodes. Now, the basic question is, can you find the planted clique? And really, the way you should think about it is the larger omega is, the easier it is to find, because it stands out more, right? And so just some basic background about this problem. So what I claim is that there's a quasi-polynomial time, so n to the log n, which finds the planted clique when it's larger than, when it's 2 plus epsilon times log n. So why is that? Because in an Erdős-Reinl random graph, the largest clique has size 2 log n, and all you do is you check for any 2.1 log n clique, you brute force search for it. Anytime you find it, they necessarily belong to the planted clique, and then you add in everything that has, you know, all of the edges to each of them, and that finds your clique. So that's sort of the information theoretic limit. Now, it's not a polynomial time algorithm, but it's only quasi-polynomial. And if you ask for polynomial time algorithms, then actually we have much weaker bounds. So in fact, one trivial thing that you could do is if you think about you know, planting a clique which is size root n log n for like c being 100, let's say. Well, if you think about the distribution of the degree of any node, well, if it's not in the clique, it looks like, you know, a bunch of random coin flips, which are a half. But if it is in the clique, you add in an omega to it. So if you add in a large enough omega that's, you know, enough standard deviations away, then you can just figure out which are the high degree nodes, and those will be the ones that are in your clique with high probability. Now, it turns out with, you know, all of the high-powered tools that we have in theoretical computer science for solving algorithmic problems, we can do a little bit better. So we can remove the root log. That's it. And actually, it turns out, this is a neat little bit of trivia to know, is that you can actually, through spectral techniques and through some amount of brute forcing, you can get the constant in front of the root n to be any small constant you want. So for all constants c larger than 1, larger than 0, there is a polynomial time algorithm which finds planted cliques of size c root n. But actually, how small you make the constant blows up the degree of your polynomial running time. And there's a really nice work of Deshpande and Montanari that, in nearly linear time, finds a clique of size root n over e. But there, the name of the game is doing it in nearly linear time, and it has connections to AMP, which is really neat.
Linear time, but the graph is quadratic number of edges. So
yeah, nearly linear in the number of edges. Yeah, so in the input complexity. Yeah. So, right, so planted clique, it turns out, you know, it's, you could assume that it's hard. That it's hard for polynomial time algorithms to beat root n substantially. Maybe it's hard for them to find n to the 1/3 size cliques. Maybe it's hard for them to find, you know, n to the 0.49 cliques. And this problem is old enough that it seems somewhat reasonable to assume that it's actually hard. Now, here we don't mean hardness based on NP hardness for reasons that I'll get into. But it turns out to have a ton of implications that if you assume planted clique is hard, this is called the planted clique hypothesis, you get hardness for a lot of interesting other problems. For example, it turns out that computing the best Nash equilibrium in a two-player game, you need quasi-polynomial time if you assume planted clique is hard. There are some neat results about property testing. One of the main ones, which I'll talk about towards the end, is something called sparse PCA, which is one of the first examples of a natural statistical problem which has a computational versus statistical gap. The best that you can do in terms of how small you can detect when the signal is really small with a brute force algorithm is different than what you can with a polynomial time algorithm. And the way that people prove it is through a reduction to the Plante-Clique problem. They're also, you know, it's used as a way to do public key encryption and crypto. And one cool thing is that in mathematical finance, you can create things like CDO squareds. And assuming Plante-Clique is hard, it gives you things like information asymmetry that, you know, if I were a malicious bank, I could create some sort of CDO squared that is actually defective, but you can't figure it out, which is kind of cool. But what about lower bounds? So actually, I have to confess that when we started working on this problem, I did not believe that Plante-Clique was hard. You know, I thought you could actually beat root n. So one of the real difficulties is that we don't really know how to give evidence for average case problems. So in fact, there's some literature within theoretical computer science, I'll say this abstractly, but it's an important point to know, is that not only is this problem not known to be NP-hard, but if it were NP-hard, all hell would break loose again. Well, for starters, you know, it's solvable in quasi-polynomial time, so that would have tremendous implications. But more importantly, every time you're faced with some sort of average case problem that can be used in cryptography, well, it actually means that the problem sits in NP intersect co-NP, and that means that if it really were NP-hard, the polynomial hierarchy would collapse. So for a bunch of these problems that arise in statistics and in learning, not only can we not prove that they're NP-hard, we don't believe that they're NP-hard. And so we're stuck with this landscape of a bunch of random average case problems that seem to be hard because no one has broken them yet, that don't seem at all related to each other. So one of the neat things about something like sum of squares is that it's a very powerful family of algorithms that contains lots of things as a special case. So when you prove lower bounds against it, you actually get some reasonable evidence that the problem is legitimately hard. And it changed my mind about what I believe for Plante-Clique, for example. Right, so for, yeah. So it turns out that, so it has this application to cryptography, which means that you can create public key encryptions, same as something like RSA. So something like, you know, factoring, which is the basis for RSA, is actually lives in the intersection between, you know, NP and co-NP for a lot of results. And that's actually true for problems which you can build public key encryption into, or which you can build public key encryption out of. So what that means is that for a lot of problems where we have cryptographic evidence that they're hard, that people are basing crypto systems on them, it actually means that if it were NP-hard, the polynomial hierarchy would collapse because then something that's both in NP and in co-NP would be NP-hard, and it means that the next level of the hierarchy wouldn't be different. So let me take that a bit offline and I'll explain it, but it is actually a big barrier. It's a big barrier also in statistical learning theory to proving NP-hardness for improper learning, for example. All right, so our best evidence is some type of sum of squares lower bound. And now this is definitely the most technical part of the talk, but what I want to do is I want to explain how now Bayesian ways of thinking actually lead to lower bounds for things like Plante-Clique. So first, what's the sum of squares relaxation for Plante-Clique? Well, we have the general constraints, 1 through 3. It's got to be linear. It's got to map 1 to 1. Every square polynomial has to be something non-negative. Now I'm going to have a bunch of constraints that are specific to Plante-Clique. My xi's are still supposed to encode where the clique is. So I'm going to have this Booleanity constraint that, you know, e tilde of xi squared times p is equal to e tilde of xi p. Now I'm going to have a clique size constraint that, you know, I want e tilde of the sum of the xi's because those are supposed to be indicator variables for what belongs to the clique, that it better be large. So it better be omega or at least omega. And now the important thing is where the graph comes in. So here the graph actually comes in the constraints of the sum of squares, because when you observe the graph, anytime you're missing an edge, you know that that pair of nodes can't both be in the clique. So the way that you do this is that every time that you have something which is not an edge, so if ij is not an edge in your observed graph, then when you look at e tilde of xi times xj times p, well, you know that both xi and xj are not supposed to be one at the same time because they can't belong to the same clique because they're missing the edge between them. So the way that you enforce that is you enforce that e tilde of xi times xj times p is equal to 0. Does that make sense? All right. So these are constraints that are now specific to planted clique. And actually, what was an open question up until like about 2 years ago, it wasn't known whether planted clique could spectacularly break the SOS could spectacularly break the planted clique hypothesis. So it wasn't known whether you could even find n to the epsilon for any epsilon size planted cliques. So on the one hand, we had this really mysterious state of affairs where people were using the planted clique hypothesis to imply all of these other results, but we didn't even know that the sum of squares hierarchy didn't already refute that conjecture, which was kind of bizarre. So what we proved in a monstrosity of a paper was a nearly tight sum of squares lower bound. Now we showed that essentially the way to read this is that for any d which is little o of log n, we proved a n to the half minus little o of 1 lower bound. That sum of squares cannot tell the difference between an Erdős-Rényi random graph and the planted clique distribution as long as the planted clique has size n to the half minus little o of 1. Now there's going to be a surprise, a Bayesian surprise in what needs to be done to do this kind of thing. And I think that's a really neat intersection between theoretical computer science and other fields, because usually theorists don't think in a very Bayesian way. But for a lot of these average case problems, there's a reason that we have to start doing that, which I'll explain. And the way to think about this is that, you know, once you get past little o of log n, so let's say you take d as, you know, log n, so with a 1 in front, then you're running in time n to the d, so you're actually getting, n to the log n, then you're getting essentially the brute force quasi-polynomial time algorithm that I already gave you. So what this means is a strong statement that, sum of squares interpolates almost trivially between the spectral algorithm and brute force search for size log n cliques. And actually, there were a bunch of works, which I'll tell you a little bit about, which this builds on. And that's what I'm really going to tell you, at least some of the ways we had to think about it in a more Bayesian way to sort of improve on some of the barriers where this got stuck. So there's one technical tool which I'm going to show you, which is something that I'm going to call pseudo-calibration. And it is going to give us new insights into sort of both what makes SOS powerful, but also how to go about fooling it. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the existing approaches and actually where they break. Yeah? I defined it actually as just an optimization with a bunch of constraints, so just the feasibility question. But you could think about it as maximizing the sum of the xi's, but you only care about when it has a value at least omega, which it will because it's a relaxation. So you can think about it either as a feasibility or as an optimization problem. Great, so the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you actually some of the earlier results and actually what breaks, because something really interesting happens. So, you know, the main question here is, it's the converse of what we did for max cut. It's really, I give you an Erdős-Rényi random graph, it's GN 1/2. We know from elementary, probability, just from Chernoff bounds and union bounds, that there is no large clique in this graph with high probability. But what we want to do is we want to fool sum of squares into thinking that there is a large one. We want to create a pseudo-expectation that somehow can pretend that there are many variables xi that are set to 1, at least omega of them, even though there isn't actually a way to do that with an actual honest clique. So the usual approach, as I mentioned, sum of squares is a strengthening of a lot of weaker hierarchies. So usually what you do is you take, whatever problem you want to prove a lower bound for, and you look at what people did for weaker hierarchies, and then you just kind of try and do the same thing. So in fact, it works for like random CSPs all the time, and in fact, in the context of planted clique, Feige and Krauthkamer studied this weaker hierarchy called the LS plus hierarchy, and showed a really strong lower bound that the LS plus hierarchy fails at finding planted cliques of size root n over 2 to the d. So really, to beat root n, you do have to go out to d is about log n. Or d, if d is little o of log n, it doesn't work. And that actually turns out to sort of work, but not really. So that's the approach that Mecca, Petechen, and Vigerson used, to show that at least planted clique doesn't find cliques of size n to the 1 over d. So, you know, for d equals 2, that's pretty good because it's saying that it's not beating spectral. That's nice. But it doesn't remove the possibility that by going to higher and higher degrees, you can do much better in the polynomial size that you need for the clique. And so here's what they do, and I'm going to call these the Mecca-Petechin-Vigdorsson pseudo-moments. The way that they constructed their integrality gap, their guess for what e tilde ought to look like, is they set it equal to this expression. This expression is actually very intuitive, is that anytime you give me a set A, right, that's a set of nodes, and what I care about is what I should map the monomial, which is the product of xi over the i's that belong to A. Now, the first thing is that if that set A doesn't induce a clique, then it should be zero, right? Because we know that not all of those guys should be in the clique together. And that was explicitly in our constraints for the sum of squares, right? Because remember that the xi's are supposed to encode which belongs to the clique. So anytime you have a set A that's not a clique, then you better have the fact that they're not all simultaneously in the planted clique. So does that make sense? Are there questions about it? Okay, but what if it is a clique? What you're going to do is you're going to try and hide which nodes actually belong to the clique as much as possible. So if you think about omega as the size of the clique, so, you know, if this were a random, you know, the chance that these random nodes, the set of A, lands in the clique is like omega over n raised to the size of A. And what you do is you put this little corrective term in front, which is just for a given set A, what's the probability that it induces a clique is 2 to the minus A choose 2. So you rescale everything just so that the sum of these things is, you know, is correct. So everything that, you know, is definitely not a clique in the planted clique because it doesn't induce one, you set it to zero. Everything else, you set it to the same value, so it should have the same chance of belonging to the planted clique, but you boost it up to, you know, make sure that the overall pseudo-expectation is the right thing. And now this tells you exactly what their construction is, because what does their pseudo-expectation operator look like? You just extend this definition by linearity to all polynomials. So that's their guess for what should work. And, you know, they actually did prove this result about n to the 1 over d, and their approach was a lot of hard random matrix theory because it was a lot of spectral bounds on something called locally random matrices. You know, after that, Deshpande and Montanari improved it in the case of d equals 4 to the result n to the 1/3. And then Hopkins, Kothari, and Petechin showed that actually for any d, the right answer is 1 to the n to the 1 over ceiling of d over 2 plus 1. And these bounds actually turn out to be tight for the Mecca-Petechin-Vigdorsson moments. They do not work beyond this, which is actually one of the big surprises. So in fact, let me prove for you that they don't work, and now we can finally get into a sort of Bayesian way of thinking about it. Is this was a polynomial that John Kellner came up with. It's a beautiful idea. So let me tell you what polynomial breaks their pseudo-moments. So this polynomial, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have these variables g, I, j. So I'm going to fix some node I in the graph. and looking out from it and looking at all the other nodes, I'm going to have g, I, j as plus 1 if I has an edge to j, and it's minus 1 otherwise. And I'm going to form this polynomial. This p, g, I is just for any node I sum over j of gij times xj, and then raise it to the lth power. Okay? So now the important thing is that let's imagine that there really were a planted clique of size omega in the graph, and that moreover, the way that I set the xi and xj's was as indicator variables of which things belong to the planted clique. What I claim is that if you were to take a graph from this planted clique distribution, and you took x to be the indicator variable of which things belong to the planted clique, that the expectation of pgi squared, well, this would be at least omega over n times omega to the 2l. So where does this come from? Is because there's an omega over n chance that the node I belongs to the planted clique, because it's planted at random. And what happens if I belongs to the planted clique, and then all of the other xj's are the indicator variables of the planted clique? Well, you only get omega non-zeros, but they all add up with plus 1. So you get omega inside the sum, and that gets raised to the 2L power now because I'm taking the square of the polynomial. So I get at least omega over n times omega to the 2L. But now something bad is going to happen, is that let's look at what the pseudo-expectation operator is trying to do. So if we take the expectation of the pseudo-expectation operator, there are a lot of expectations here, over the Erdős-Rényi random graphs, it's actually going to be too small. So how do you see that? Is because if you take this PGI squared, and then to the L, a PGI squared, and you expand this, you know, raising this linear sum to the 2L power, so the only way that you're going to get a non-zero contribution from the expectation is if every variable gij that shows up with a non-zero xi is actually double covered. So your only choice is to actually pick out L different choices for the nodes, their n to the L possibilities, and each one of them, when it is a clique, the Mecca, Petesha, and Vigdorsson moments will assign it the value omega over n to the L. But this is a problem because actually these two expressions don't match. In fact, this upper bound is smaller than this lower bound whenever you have omega is less than n to the 1 over L plus 1. So that's exactly where the tightness of these relaxations come from, is that there's some sort of functional that you can apply that ends up having the wrong expectation of its pseudo-expectation compared to what it would be in the actual planted clique distribution. So it turns out that you can turn this into an honest square polynomial whose pseudo-expectation is non-negative. And the intuition for this is that a good pseudo-expectation is trying to hide as much information as possible about where the planted clique is, and it tried to be too uniform. It tried to make every size A clique about the same chance of being in the planted clique. But it hid information too well, because it turns out that what you can show is what's really going on is that some nodes really do have a standard deviation higher average degree in GN 1/2. Those are nodes which you actually have to update the chance that you think they're in the planted clique, not by something small, by 1 plus little of 1, but by an actual constant factor. And so, in fact, the problem was that there are things that someone could reason about just from a Bayesian standpoint that weren't captured within the approach for this integrality gap. So it turns out that people realized this and fixed it for the degree 4 case. They actually, that ends up being the only polynomial that goes wrong in the degree 4 relaxation. But you know, their approach was just to explicitly correct those family of polynomials. And you can ask, is there a fix for, you know, higher degrees? So the first, you know, papers on this were 36 pages, then there were 40 pages, and all the way at the end for the degree 4 case, it was a 70-page paper. And in fact, something ironic happens, that for degree 6, the fixes need fixes, which is really annoying. So I remember I had, you know, notebooks full of calculations, which were these brutal random matrix calculations, and it was not so clear how many pages there would be. It was clear there would be 3 question marks because it would be larger than 100, but I didn't know beyond that. But it turns out there's a neat way to do, you know, to figure out what is the right way to fix all of the pseudo moments by taking a Bayesian approach. And this is what's called pseudo calibration. So if I get across this, I will be happy. So you see, you think about what went wrong with the MPW moments. What went wrong was that there's some function, which is a function of the graph and also of these x variables, which on the one hand, you take the expectation with respect to the Erdős-Rényi, and on the other hand, you take the expectation with respect to the planted clique distribution, where you think about sampling a graph G along with the indicator vectors of where the planted clique is. And the problem was that these two sides didn't match. They were very far off from each other. You know, that's exactly what this Kellner polynomial was disparity between these two sides. So what you can do is you can ask, well, can I make this inequality for some notion of all simple functions f? And here, simple functions is going to be polynomials that are low degree in the gij variables and the xj's. So that's our idea, is that This is called pseudo-calibration, as you want to pretend that one distribution on the left behaves like the distribution on the right by showing that, you know, for all simple functions, it looks the same. So here's how we're going to do it, and there's a neat way to do it with some cute Fourier analysis. So if you think about the pseudo-expectation operator, let's look at it instead as we fix a monomial, xA. So this is the product of all xi, where I belongs to A. And this monomial, whatever, you know, the pseudo-expectation evaluates this to, is a function of the graph, right? Because, for example, if the graph comes back and A is not a clique, then it better map it to zero. Otherwise, it can map it to non-zero. But we can think about it now, the pseudo-expectation on a particular monomial, as a function of the graph to the reals. And so, in fact, what I can do is I can define the notion of a character, because I'm going to use Fourier analysis. So I can think about a set, a T, which is really a set of edges. And I can think about, you know, this function gij, which is plus one if the edge is there and minus one otherwise. And I can take the product of all of those things for the edges that are in T. And so just through, you know, the usual Fourier analysis, we can write down whatever this function ought to be. However e tilde of xa ought to map a graph to a real value, we can express it in the Fourier basis instead. Because all it is it's a linear combination of these Fourier characters, where these Fourier characters spit, you know, take in the graph and spit out a plus minus one value, and then we have some Fourier coefficient. So here I haven't done anything. I've just said, however I decide to cleverly set the pseudo-expectation of this monomial depending on the graph, I can think about it instead as setting its Fourier coefficients. Nothing fancy. And the main question now is, how should you set the Fourier coefficients? Because some of the initial guesses weren't Bayesian enough and didn't satisfy the pseudo-calibration condition. Now, it turns out there's a nice way that we can do this. So let's use the same expression we have, where we have that we've written e tilde of xa as a function of the graph using its Fourier expansion. That's the same thing we had on the previous slide. Well, what I can do now is I can calculate one side of the pseudo-calibration. I can take the expectation over gn 1/2. And I can evaluate whatever this is. So if I plug in, you know, xt of g right here with xa, then what I'm going to get is, by linearity, I can pull out the character, because that, you know, the pseudo-expectation operator is linear. And now I can plug in this formula I have for e tilde of xa as a function of the graph. And what do? I just multiply this entire thing by this, you know, chi t of g, the Fourier character. So now this becomes really nice, because what can I say about e of chi t of g times e of chi t prime of g?
Orthogonal,
exactly. So it's one if and only if t equals t prime. That makes my life a lot easier, and that means I just pull out the Fourier coefficient. All I've done is I've used the usual Fourier expansion, the way that you compute the Fourier coefficients, but in conjunction with e tilde. That's all I've done. And now I can use this ansatz that this is supposed to be equal to the other side with pseudo-calibration. It should be equal to the expectation over the planted clique distribution of what happens when you take the graph and you take the indicator vector of the planted clique and you plug that in to the same low-degree polynomial in the variables and the graph, right? And so now I can calculate exactly what this is. I claim it's omega over n to the size of the number of vertices in T union A. So why is this? Because, first of all, every node in A better show up in the planted clique, otherwise I'm going to set it to zero and the expectation will be zero. So I get, you know, there's an omega over n raised to the size of A chance that you get all of those nodes in the planted clique, but it also depends on, you know, T. Because, you know, chi t of g, you know, that's some sort of parity function. As soon as I include among its vertices something that does not belong to the planted clique, its expectation would be zero, because it has some edge that's a complete random variable. It's random and its expectation is zero. So that's exactly what you get, and this turns out to be the right way to set the pseudo-expectation. So in fact, you know, what do? We set e tilde of xa to be equal to exactly this Fourier expansion, where we plug in those Fourier coefficients that came through our pseudo-calibration computation. So there is some technicalities that you have to stop this at some point up to some threshold tau and truncate it, because it's supposed to be some sort of low-degree polynomial anyways. I won't go through some of the details, but you can prove lots of nice things about this. You can prove nice things like, you know, it really does have the property that if A is not a clique, then it assigns the value 0. That's not totally obvious, but it follows from things like the Fourier expansion of the AND function and grouping terms in the right way. And it turns out that the hardest part of this is actually proving positivity, but you can through a bunch of dependent random matrix theory. Interestingly, it ends up being a lot easier to show that the expectation of E tilde of P squared is non-zero, because we've set it up that way, because it's supposed to be equal to an actual expectation over the Plantin clique distribution. So that's actually all I'm going to say about that. It's still a kind of technical paper, but the nice thing is that it gives you a general recipe that in a lot of lower bounds for sum of squares... Okay. Yeah, so I'm actually just going to do a little bit of an epilogue, so, and then, yeah, feel free to interrupt me with questions. But what's interesting is that, you know, for most of the lower bounds within sum of squares, they're all for things like, you know, random 3-sat or random 3-xor. Those are things where you don't need to be Bayesian, because what ends up happening is that your pseudo-expectation has a lot of local constraints. You know, when you have variables appearing in the same clause, there are a lot of constraints about how those variables are set together. But when you talk about variables that are far away in the clause graph, all of the dependencies go to 0. So what's different about a lot of the problems that people are attacking now is that there are actual, you know, global constraints. When I have a node which has a standard deviation higher degree, that does tell me something interesting that a computationally bounded observer really could deduce about the Plantin clique. And the sum of squares incorporates a lot of those forms of reasoning, so you need to incorporate it too in order to actually defeat it. So one thing that I want to mention at least, you know, like now I just want to at least take a step back and tell you at least where this fits in. You know, I mentioned there are things, you know, there are other problems where Plantin clique was used to show some sort of lower bounds. So one of the famous examples, it's what's called sparse principal component analysis. What you do is you're given samples from a Gaussian random vector. It's a Gaussian random variables. And it has a spiked covariance, so it has zero mean, and its covariance is the identity plus theta VV transpose, where V is the spike, so V is k-sparse. And just for simplicity, you can think about its entries as being plus minus 1 over root k, so it's a unit vector. And the basic question that people care about here is how large does the signal parameter theta need to be in order for you to be able to detect the spike? So it turns out the same way that in Plantin clique we had a trivial brute force algorithm that got down to the information theoretical limit, and then we had something weaker for polynomial time algorithms, well, the same type of thing happens here for sparse PCA, that it turns out that there's a d to the k algorithm, so it's in dimension d, and you're getting n samples. So in dimension d, you need this parameter theta to be at least root k log d over n. But if you ask, and the, you know, the approach for it is what you would do is you do this brute force search, if you take a bunch of samples, you compute their empirical covariance matrix, and you look at the top singular value of all k by k principal submatrices. So that's a d to the k search, but that ends up working down to the information theoretic limits. But if you ask for a polynomial time algorithm, you pay this extra factor of k squared in what you need the signal to be. And in fact, the way that you select out where the spike is ends up being much more trivial. All you do is you take the empirical covariance and you look for the large values along the diagonal. And this turns out to be tight in the sense that what they showed, what Berthet and Rigolet showed, is actually for a sub-Gaussian variant of sparse PCA. They showed that if Plantin clique really is hard to solve with polytime algorithms, beneath this threshold of n to the 1/2, that it implies that you actually can't get the signal parameter to be noticeably better than k squared. But, you know, one of the neat things that I think, you know, sum of squares enables when you talk about evidence for computational intractability is that it allows you to give a more refined view of how hard the problem actually is. So remember that Plantin clique is only quasi-polynomially hard. So you could wonder all kinds of questions like, you know, is sparse PCA only quasi-polynomial hard or is it exponentially hard? So, you know, you're sort of out of luck if you're trying to use reductions again, because Pointed clique and sparse PCA look a lot alike, but if you want something harder, you know, what average case problem are you going to start with for showing the reduction? Who knows? Will it be well studied? Probably not. But what you can do is you can still hope to prove strong sum of squares lower bounds. So for example, Hopkins et al., building on some of the pointed clique results, actually proved much stronger than logarithmic lower bounds on the degree for a Wigner variant of the sparse PCA. So in this setting, it gives you evidence not just for is a problem hard for polytime in an average case, but you can also get more refined notions like how hard ought it be? Should it be exponentially hard to get beneath it? So instead of actually giving a bunch of Gaussian samples, you're going to generate an actual Gaussian Wigner matrix, and then you're going to add, you know, theta U transpose on top of it. Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's probably, I'm not sure it should be that different for the reductions, but, you know, it is at least a caveat in there. And the other neat thing, which I really want to at least mention to a statistical physics crowd, is that, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, for a while, we had no idea how strong pointed clique was. We had it as an assumption, but we didn't know that sum of squares didn't already refute it. Now that we've sort of climbed this mountain of actually being able to prove average case lower bounds for sum of squares, you know, you can wonder about maybe it should be much easier to defeat sum of squares. Maybe sum of squares, you know, it when it only interpolates in a trivial way between spectral and brute force search, maybe when low degree polynomials fail, it should fail too. So you could hope that maybe there's a sort of more formulaic way to prove sum of squares lower bounds, that if your two distributions, Erdős-Reinl and pointed clique, match on all small subgraph counts, then maybe that's enough to fool sum of squares. So we don't quite know that, but we know something close. That it turns out that there's a simulation theorem that if degree D sum of squares works, under some sort of assumptions about re-randomizing the distribution, there is a spectral algorithm that will work too. But now the spectral algorithm, what it does is it creates an end of the D by end of the D matrix in which the entries of that matrix are low degree polynomials in the random instance you're given. And taking the top non-negative eigenvalue of that would distinguish between the planted and unplanted distributions. So in fact, you could wonder about whether, you know, there are ways to prove that these low degree matrix polynomial methods don't work. That would give you a great way to explore sum of squares hardness for all sorts of problems, but we don't actually know how to prove those kinds of bounds. So, you know, there's a lot of hope for, you know, things like small subgraph conditioning methods, tools like contiguity, to help us be able to prove pointed clique lower bounds in a more formulaic way, or even more optimistically, can we prove things like SOS fails for community detection beneath the Kesten-Stegum bound? We know a lot about contiguity there, but not quite these matrix polynomials that show up in what you need to defeat sum of squares. So that's all I had to say. So this was, usually I don't like giving sum of squares talks, and I still don't, because it's certainly one of the more technical areas. It has this reputation of being very hard because everyone always introduces it from Hilbert's 17th problem and bores you with proof complexity. But the neat thing that I hope you take with this is that sum of squares, if you think about it from the viewpoint of average case analysis, it doesn't need to be like that. You can think about it through pseudo-expectation, through pseudo-calibration, and there are a lot of ways in which the things that people are looking for to defeat sum of squares or to prove that it works even really have a lot to do with some types of Bayesian techniques. So I think there's a lot of scope for some sort of cross-fertilization between communities that have a lot of powerful probabilistic tools and understanding how to make those tools play with pseudo-expectations and semi-definite programming to get good algorithms. So in particular, I introduced sum of squares hierarchies not as a proof complexity technique, but as a relaxation for polynomial optimization. I gave you upper bounds for max cut, which were based on Gaussian rounding, so you were matching the pseudo-moments with the moments of an actual distribution. And then I showed you lower bounds for pointed clique, or at least some of the things that go wrong with the usual approaches, and why you need to think about it in a more Bayesian way. And maybe more excitingly, I talked about, you know, why do we care about SOS lower bounds is because we can't really, you know, prove things based on NP hardness. We're stuck in this, you know, average case complexity landscape with a bunch of unrelated assumptions. And every time we want a more refined understanding, it seems like we need to make a new assumption. Who knows if it's true or not? At least sum of squares gives us a unified way to talk about what is some reasonable form of evidence. And this evidence can even give you ideas about which problem is not just hard for poly time, but is even hard, you know, you might need exponential time to beat some thresholds. So that's all I have. You guys asked a lot of great questions, but I'm happy to take any more.
Okay, so Heather. So what are we currently missing in order to get a SOS lower bound for a problem that is believed to be exponentially hard, not only pseudo-polynomial?
So we have plenty of lower bounds there, but for random CSPs. So for random 3-sat, for example, there are linear degree lower bounds on whether you can refute a random 3-sat formula with 100 n log n clauses. But we don't actually have any exponential lower bounds for average case problems that I'm aware of.
Right, I meant more like statistics problems, like where you are looking for some signal, something of the community detection type or
You asked like what tools are we missing or?
Like what's the state of the art? Like for, you mentioned the community detection. So
yep.
So for instance, like what is the status of trying SOS lower bound for the KS threshold to be SOS lower bound?
Wide open. Many people have tried and all have come back defeated. Seems very, very hard. See, right now for planted clique already, not only did I lose constant factors, I lost polylogarithmic factors too.
Right. Or you could do planted clique if the clique is like epsilon n with small epsilon.
So that,
and it's
so
not
that
the clique, it's just
that's
dense.
A great question. Okay. So in fact, that I'm more optimistic about. So one of the questions that people had been stuck on for a little bit, and every few months I hear some rumors that people have done it or not, is the densest subgraph problem. So instead of actually planting the subgraph, that's something that would be exponentially hard, and we have LS plus lower bounds. Now, it turns out that there are sort of low probability events in a lot of the, you have to deal with in some of the planted dense subgraph things that don't arise here. So there are some sorts of, you can think about like the small subgraph conditioning method or things like this that tell you some subgraphs really do have some constant chance of, showing up and distinguishing between two different models. Those things show up in the planted dense subgraph problem in a way that they don't for planted clique. Now, I haven't personally thought about that question, so I don't know more than that sort of Cliff Notes version, but that's at least one of the ones where like the fact that we're never hoping to be as sharp down to the constant factor with a lot of these results, you could still hope to prove exponential lower bounds for some of those types of problems. And that would be really neat because that's also another popular average case assumption.
In what sense are you using the term Bayesian? It seems very loose that you're in any rigorous manner?
In the pseudo, for starters, when we're creating a pseudo expectation, there is no distribution. There's absolutely no distribution on large cliques because there just aren't any. But the sense in which we're using Bayesian is the pseudo calibration notion. That someone who's making inferences based on computationally boundedly looking at the graph, looking at things like which nodes have a larger degree than average by a standard deviation, well, actually the pseudo expectation needs to reflect that because E tilde of Xi is really the probability, it's supposed to act like the probability that the convex programming relaxation thinks that I belongs to the clique. So a lot of deductions that you can do with like simple computationally bounded subgraph counts are things that have to be reflected within the way that you choose the pseudo expectation.
So there's a sense of prior that you're using Bayesian.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. But it's not literally a posterior distribution because there is no distribution on large cliques. Instead, it's a consistency with some types of low degree Bayesian reasoning.
Heather, other questions?
And if you move from planted cliques to the sparse version, which is essentially planted independent sets, and the fact that you move to a sparse model makes these tools much more hard to apply.
Yes, absolutely. So for example, like this is stuff that I didn't get into, but we had to truncate the pseudo, the way that we chose the pseudo expectation operator. There, in a lot of cases, we're using hypercontractivity to reason about why that's okay. even something like what e tilde of 1 is, it won't actually be equal to 1, it'll be close to 1, but then you can renormalize it. That uses hypercontractivity, and the fact that you're really looking at concentration bounds for low-degree polynomials in dense settings. So take your pick, and what this means is that, you know, all of these things need to be really sharpened to have any hope of proving those kinds of lower bounds. But it's a great question. I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's merely very hard.
Okay, yeah. Other questions? Well, if not, we thank Ms. Peter again.